any doubt, that'd be crazy. But look, some people say I'm a glutton for punishment with these startups. I think it's the challenge of starting something from nothing and seeing it come to fruition is more rewarding than anything else I've ever done.
Welcome to Hot Coffee Cold Beer. I'm your host, Brock Hendricks, with the LA Lakers, Clippers, and Kings. On this podcast, we'll sit down and share a hot coffee or cold beer with those who have made a name for themselves working inside the highly competitive sports industry. All the content heard today is solely reflective of the independent reporting by Hot Coffee Cold Beer and our team and does not reflect the opinion or feelings of AEG, Staples Center, the LA Lakers, Clippers, Kings, or Sparks. Today's guest is 2019 Wise Women of Inspiration Award winner Heather Brooks Carrots, an accomplished veteran of the sports industry with stops in the NFL, NHL, as a key piece in the launching of the LAFC franchise in Major League Soccer, and most recently as president of the Los Angeles Wildcats in the XFL. You'll hear about the infancy stages in the building of million-dollar sports brands from the ground up, about being a part of ending the NHL lockout, and about some stories behind the scenes of the XFL's closing days. And you'll hear about how a round of drinks at Buffalo Wild Wings helped Heather become one of the first female presidents of a football team ever. Full disclosure, since we recorded with Heather, the XFL was rumored to have reached a bankruptcy deal with a judge in New York that would allow the league to be purchased by a group that includes Redbird Capital, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and entrepreneur Danny Garcia. If and when that deal becomes official, this would make Danny the first female owner of a sports league ever. We hope you enjoy the story and the lessons behind Heather Brooks Carrots. Hey, Heather, thank you so much for joining us. Do you have a hot coffee or a cold beer ready to go?
Hi, thanks for having me. I do have a hot coffee. I had one too many drinks last night, so I need it this afternoon.
Good recovery on the coffee. I'm insanely honored to talk to you today. Just we wanted to talk to you because, you know, you are not only a startup operation warrior, which is extremely rare to find in the sports industry, but this is an important storytelling career growth narrative for the show that we can talk to the very first female president of a pro football team and learn how you paved the way and how we can kind of pave the way for other women to be the next in line. Thank you so much for coming on and spending some time with us.
I mean, anyone who's going to call me a startup operations warrior, I'd love to spend as much time with you as possible.
I'm not wrong. You know, it's a good title. Put that on your resume.
I will. Thank you for that.
I heard you on an interview recently where you said that your family presented you with two options when you were younger: go to law school or go to med school. So how do those two options lead you to a career in sports?
It's true. Both my parents are physicians and, you know, we came from a family where education was really important. And the only opportunities I knew about were med school and law schools. I thought at first I would follow in my parents' footsteps and go be an orthopedic surgeon and work in sports, and quickly realized I didn't want to be in school till I was 35 and then have to dig out of a bigger hole of loans. So I quickly ruled that out and said, I guess law school it is. But I was an athlete growing up. I played a lot of sports and I watched a lot of sports with my family. I started to think about how I could find a profession that melded my interest and love for sports in some way. So when I was 18 years old, I had the opportunity to graduate early from high school and I took an internship with the Verizon Center. It was the MCI Center at the time and now it's Cap One Center, but it's where the Wizards and the Caps play. And at the time, Michael Jordan was playing for the Wizards. So that was my first job in sports. I was an intern there. I helped the venue with a lot of sponsorship and partnership activations. But I got an amazing taste of what it was like to be in this industry. And from there, I knew that I had to explore it further and figure out, you know, a path to get in and do something that resonated with me. I still went to law school and I worked at the NFL Management Council, which is a division of the NFL that helps resolve disputes between players and clubs. And I was a law clerk there while I was in school. And this was the first time that I really understood about collective bargaining and how a lawyer could really add value in the sports world. So one of the cool cases I got to work on was when Michael Vick got arrested for dogfighting. I was at the league representing the Atlanta Falcons trying to claw back bonus money at the time. And I just thought, this was so cool and I had to do more. So from there, all my mentors in the space said, you know, you have to go to a big law firm and get trained at a law firm before you can go back into sports. So that's what I did. I went to a large firm, was a labor and employment litigator and got some great training and good experience under my belt, but knew that that just wasn't for me long term. Some personal things popped up. I moved across the country from LA back to New York and actually quit my job cold turkey in the middle of the recession and had to figure out what to do with my life. Started my own company that was a brand called Sports Girl. It was a sports digital brand a long time ago before when blogging was just starting. So that was a good taste of the entrepreneurial world. But while I was doing that, I got a call from the NHL who said, you know, we'd love to have another lawyer in house. It's likely that we're going to have a work stoppage and we could use some extra hands. And when I got that call, I said, how could you ever turn that down? So of course, I joined the NHL, had an amazing experience there. There was a work stoppage and we negotiated a new collective bargaining agreement. Then moved back to LA and helped start Relativity Sport from the ground up, which became the third largest sports agency in the country, representing mostly players in the NFL, NBA, and MLB. I served as an agent. I helped with sports productions and other sports business ventures and investments. And from there, I then joined a couple years later, I joined LAFC at the ground stages of when we put shovels in the ground for building our stadium. I was the executive vice president and general counsel, and then most recently the president of the Los Angeles Wildcats of the XFL.
The LAFC launch was really revolutionary and probably a pretty special moment in your career, but it had to be super challenging because the expectations in Los Angeles are just always heighted beyond reality. And while you guys blew it out of the park, it started with a blank sheet of paper, a brand new expansion team where soccer already was, with no stadium, with no brand, with no team name. So how did this all come together to go from scratch to a pretty competitive Major League Soccer team?
It was a crazy journey, and you're right. There are a lot of reasons that you start out with saying, how is this going to work? But I think there were a few things that were fundamentally done right at the beginning to help lead it towards success. The first was the location of the venue. It was really important that somebody took advantage of Exhibition Park in downtown, and this was the right league and team to do that. So there's a great plot of land, great location, which is also right next to public transportation. So when you think about cultivating a younger fan base in a city that's really transitioning, being on the expo line was a huge advantage. The second thing is that I'm not sure everyone listening remembers, but there was a second MLS team, Chivas, in LA some time ago that did not work out. So there was this existing fan base of soccer fans in LA who had such a rivalry with the Galaxy when they were Chivas fans that they couldn't go be Galaxy fans and they were looking for a new team to root for. So when LAFC came around, they were like, perfect, this is great. And these were folks who were dedicated to soccer, already understood and knew MLS, and most importantly, knew what it meant to be a supporter. They really had the understanding and fundamental knowledge to build the amazing supporter group that is now the 3252 of LAFC. And then we had the right ownership, management, and timeline and trajectory to make it work. I mean, this did not happen overnight. It happened over several years. And I remember when the stadium was under construction, every Sunday, these diehard fans who were the beginning core of our supporter group would meet in the parking lot during construction outside the shell of the stadium and practice their chants and their songs and start organizing together, because the community of LAFC actually was a truly grassroots effort that developed years before we actually stepped on the pitch.
The 3252 Club is something we definitely have to touch on because it's such a unique part of sports, and especially in LA sports. LA sports is so much, for better or for worse, a kind of city where it's, what have you done for me lately? And lately means today, not yesterday. How do you get a 3252 Club to engage in a franchise that literally hasn't been started yet, years before you'll ever play a game, and years before the 3252 Club can sit out and chant and basically make Bank of California Stadium feel like a European soccer stadium? How do you get that to start when you literally haven't started a franchise?
I think it was really important to put faces to the team. So we didn't have a coach, we didn't have a player, but we definitely had owners who were willing to be public about their investment and excitement in LAFC. And I think that distinguished us from AEG and the Galaxy a little bit. There was a humanity component where there were individuals in LA saying, oh, you know, Will Ferrell or Mia Hamm are individuals who are connecting themselves with LAFC. I want to be a part of that too. And I think that helped create a personal connection. The other thing that LAFC did that was really smart, and this was done before I was there, so I will take no credit, is they actually developed their academy program before the pro team program. So when we were still building our stadium and trying to find professional players for our team, we had youth clubs that were already playing. The 3252 fans would actually go to the academy games and cheer on the team. And it was just an amazing sort of memory for me, because these were individuals who had full-time jobs and on a Saturday would drive a couple hours and watch a game when it wasn't even their kids playing, but it's because they believed in LAFC and they believed in what we were doing. And from a marketing branding standpoint, it was really all about making sure we were a reflection of Los Angeles and the soccer culture internationally. So there was a saying in LAFC where we would go street by street, block by block, one by one, to find our fans. And that was a motto that has always rung true, that we were going to do this truly authentically and grassroots way to make sure that our fan base was there for the long term.
From shovels in the ground to a beautiful state-of-the-art pitch with Banc of California Stadium, the team had some pretty amazing success from infancy. And it's really easy to look backwards at this masterpiece of a project. But at day one, what are some of the challenges that surprised you when you were in the thick of this?
Honestly, I think we were all just sort of drowning with everything that had to get done in the timeline to make sure that we could open our building on time. And we did open it early, actually. I mean, when you think about it, this is not just about starting a soccer team. And that's actually what compelled me to take the role. It was not just about starting in a new expansion team. It was about building a $370 million facility in downtown. It was about building a $40 million training facility. It was about building an ancillary complex that had restaurants and bars and events. We have our freeway signs, and doing all of that on government land, which isn't an easy set of circumstances to maneuver within anyway. It was a lot to do. And, you know, I think I was the only lawyer in house. So what I was doing was kind of managing a massive team of law firms and external consultants and help to make sure that we could get everything done. That's one of the things I really like doing, is kind of juggling a million different issues and making sure that all the puzzle pieces are going to fit together. So it was a very large team, mostly external, and you know, we found a way to just keep pushing the boulder forward.
You described the startup operation as drowning, but yet you continue to go back to it. And it was called the most ambitious football league in decades by an ESPN reporter. And along comes the XFL that puts all its cards on the table and went outward and said, these are our lofty goals. Here's what we're going to go out and do for football. Did you have any hesitations about leaving behind this beautiful thing you had just built and moving to a startup sports league and doing another session of what you call drowning?
Well, look, if I didn't have any doubts, I'd be crazy. But look, some people say I'm a glutton for punishment with these startups. I think it's the challenge of starting something from nothing and seeing it come to fruition is more rewarding than anything else I've ever done. I'm just going to keep doing it, I guess. It was definitely a calculated decision I had to make. I loved my time at LAFC, the management there, working very closely with Larry Friedman, the chief business officer, Tom Penn, the president, and all of the owners who were amazingly invested and welcoming and inclusive for the whole staff. It was really hard to leave that environment. I also knew that we had sort of built the machine. And surely there is a lot that will get tweaked over time and continue to get built on to the behemoth that now is LAFC. But there just were fewer hurdles on the horizon for me, and I like a challenge. When I got a call from a headhunter about the XFL opportunity, I knew already that at some point in the future, I was going to have to make a move from LAFC in order to keep challenging myself. I just wasn't sure what the right thing was. I knew of the XFL from growing up 20 years ago, and I immediately had my doubts. I didn't know if this was a legitimate sports league, if it was going to be more of an entertainment property, and most importantly, was it going to be properly financed to become something meaningful? And the more due diligence I did, the more I realized that this was something different, and this was not the XFL of 20 years ago, and that the thought process around it was being done the right way. On my first interview, I had given a lot of thought and actually taken some lessons from my LAFC days as to what would make this work in Los Angeles, because a startup football team in LA is very different than a startup football team in St. Louis, for example. And I was very clear about what I thought would work and very clear about what I thought would fail. And immediately the ownership and management, the XFL, said, "You're right. We believe in you. You know this market And if you'll come on board, we want you to actually roll out and execute the vision that you've presented from day one. And so when I got that vote of confidence and affirmation that the vision that we had, that I had, was the right one, and that they were behind me 110%. And, you know, I crossed all my T's and dotted all my I's. I jumped, you know, right into the deep end and had one of the most unforgettable experiences ever.
So the XFL hires you, and I have to imagine there's a lot of pride in being named the first female president of a professional football team in a city that you were already established in, a city you love. Is that at the top of your list for accomplishments in your career?
It is one of the most exciting accomplishments, something that I've always dreamed about. I do think that there may have been some female presidents before. Amy Trask has had a really senior role with the Raiders in the past. But to do it in this way where it's truly a startup, this is not just a team launching from scratch, which was the LAFC journey. This is a league launching from scratch at the same time. So really, I mean, the first few months of my time at the XFL were really about setting the structure for the league. And because I had worked at the NFL and the NHL, you know, the league office leaned on me a lot to help set up some of the fundamental components of it based on my previous experience. So I knew that this was a moment in time that would never replicate it itself again. And when those opportunities come up, it's really, in my mind, you know, a perfect fit for me, where there's no other option other than jumping in and doing it, because I'll never get that opportunity again. I mean, at the outset, the biggest risks were, is spring football viable? I mean, I felt like the financing was there. I felt like we had the right management. And then I knew that they were behind me with the vision for how to build LA. And the question then became, do people want spring football? And I knew that in LA in particular, it had to be an affordable product. There's just too much competition here that we had to make sure that we were going to have a ticket price point that could work for everybody and for families. And that was something we committed to out of the gates. For me, it's a, you know, I said, we got to try it. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. It's because spring football doesn't work. Now, we are all here 12 plus months, years, you know, months later, and we've seen a different outcome play out, which I'm happy to dive into. But I would do it all over again, knowing what I know now.
Now we know, sitting here today, that the XFL is no longer. But let's go back to the very beginning. What are some of the first days of the XFL like? Because I remember chatting with you when we first connected. You didn't have an office yet. You were still putting the whole operation together. I think at the time, actually, you were still XFL Los Angeles. You hadn't picked a mascot. The operations, you know, you had a lot of stuff on day one you still had to get done. What are some of those memories you have about the very beginning, about day one of the XFL?
No, it was great. I mean, I was the first president hired, so there were no other presidents. A couple others came on the first month, but I was going to Connecticut probably every 2 weeks to the league office, like I said, to help with league infrastructure. We had to pick a ticketing partner, right? We had to start thinking about how we were going to source players. We didn't have a head coach in LA either. So eventually, a few months in, we got a head coach. We had a press conference. It was the first time we kind of announced ourselves locally. And then we had to think about our names and logos and uniforms and merchandise and, you know, start actually building out the schedule of how we were going to roll this out and have full stadiums in less than a year. I sort of had this twofold job of helping at the league level. And then locally, I started to think about, okay, I have a vision for how this is going to work in LA, but it's really important that we build a fan base. I didn't have a database of 50,000 emails, 100,000 emails to go tap into and start reaching out to people. I had to do it a very grassroots way, which brought back memories of the LAFC journey. So I started with, I had no special technology and data. All I had was social media. And I put out a post saying, come meet me at Buffalo Wild Wings in Carson, and let's talk all things XFL LA. And I will admit, you know, I had about 20 people show up the first time, but everyone there, you know, I sat down with at a table. I bought a round of beers. I said, I don't know if you've ever sat down with the president of a professional team before to talk, but the whole purpose of this is to hear from you, because you are the seeds of our fans. So I never, ever, ever wanted our team to be something that I, along with my staff, built in a box and just delivered to the city of LA. It had to be something that was a reflection of the city, this market, and our fans who were itching for spring football. I made that very clear out of the gate. What I realized, and I think I probably underestimated going into it, was I knew that was a good model, but it felt so genuine and authentic when I was talking to our fans, and I knew they were feeling it when I was saying it, and knew, like, we were buying into each other. and we were buying into each other for the long term. And I hope a lot of people who are listening to this either came to a game or one of our events, but within just a couple months, hundreds of people at the bars coming out to support us. And it was not just a particular demographic. This was families. This was all age groups. Our game day at the XFL, when we did our data collection, we had the highest rating across all the teams and was the highest rating from a multicultural standpoint, but also with families, which is exactly what we wanted to do in this market, because those are sort of underserved groups when it came to a live sporting event. So I knew that we were successful with the model and the message, but that we were also building generational long fans, because grandparents, parents, grandkids were all coming together. And I knew that that would foster fandom for the next generation and into the long term.
That is such a grassroots approach to building a fan base and starting these fanhoods, is literally sitting down at a Buffalo Wild Wings for a round of drinks with these people. What's maybe some of the feedback that those fans gave you sitting down for drinks with a team president?
It was great. So, I mean, one of the very clear messages across the board was, don't keep talking to me about affordable tickets and then, you know, rip me off when it comes to parking and concessions. And immediately we put that into action and we said, okay, well, if we're going to ask you to buy a $25 ticket, our parking has to be reasonable too. Some other events at Dignity Health Sports Park were charging $100 and we charged $20, and $20 to tailgate, which is really, really affordable. And then, you know, I had a lot of folks who were requesting, yes, to bring back the LA Extreme name from 20 years ago, which was a really good idea and something I had thought a lot about, because I thought it would be great to bring back at least the name in LA, because we had won the championship with the first XFL. But we came around with the Wildcats, and I think the color scheme and logo and sort of symbolic nature of the Wildcats that we built was the perfect fit.
What was it like working for Vince McMahon? Because that's a big personality. And someone who's already running a sports league on their own and had tried the XFL before back in 2001 with a drastically different business model. What were some of your impressions of him from an employer standpoint working underneath him?
Look, he's a really brilliant and successful guy. And so I went into this thinking, let me absorb as much as possible from him that, you know, I can then utilize with the XFL or on a future journey in my life. He was great about that. I think, you know, I was able to take away a lot of lessons from his success. For the most part with the XFL, he was pretty hands off. You know, he recognized that he hired myself and the other team presidents because we knew the markets really well and we needed to be deployed and run it on our own. And he was very supportive of us and our highs and lows throughout the journey.
One of the white whales for us on the show and on Hot Coffee Cold Beer is your former boss, Oliver Luck. I just think his story and I think everything about him as a businessman is really fascinating. What are some of the impressions or stories maybe that you can tell us, because he's never going to come on this show? Maybe give us a preview or paint a picture of what Oliver Luck is really like.
Oh, don't count Oliver out. He might just show up for you.
I've heard he's like the most astounding citizen, but he's not coming on Hot Coffee Cold Beer. Like, let's be honest.
Oliver's a really good guy. I think what Oliver does really well is he manages from kind of a 30,000 foot view. And it's a particular style that doesn't work for everybody. But what it allows is it allows you to do your job. It allows you to appreciate the fact that someone in management really is relying on you and trusts you and wants to let you do your thing. And Oliver was really supportive of that. And whenever I needed him to come out to LA for, you know, an event or to help with the sponsorship discussion or player issue or something, he was available. And I'm grateful for that. It was really a pleasure working with him. And also a pleasure to work with Jeffrey Pollock, who's the president and oversaw the fan engagement side of the business. Jeffrey and I probably worked a little bit more closely together because we were overlapping a lot on the business side. And, you know, Jeffrey has a lot of great experiences and a lot of value to add to everything that we were doing. So a great team all around and appreciative of the relationships that came out of it.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening and hope you're enjoying your own version of a hot coffee or a cold beer wherever you're tuning in from. The show you heard today is not possible without the help of our sponsor, Attorney Marketing Network. If you're a legal professional anywhere around the world, Attorney Marketing Network can help you grow your search rankings. And did you know that 38% of Americans use a search engine in hope of finding their lifelong lawyer? So if your SEO is holding you back from these lasting relationships, just go to attorneymarketingnetwork.com to schedule a free consultation. That's attorneymarketingnetwork.com. Now back to the show. it seemed like this was working out. It seemed like the XFL was here to stay. The television rights were there. The XFL was offering some new solutions to some of the issues that modern day football likes to neglect and instead of looking closer into. And some of the things that the XFL brought in revolutionary wise, access to players better than the NFL does, or some improved rule changes, and even expansion seemed to be going well, where the XFL had this idea called Team 9, where a scout team would literally keep a roster full of players, and a scout would keep them game ready in case they were going to get signed. It seemed like everything was flowing along smoothly, and then at the end of March, suddenly, it's announced the season's over. And you get on social media with your twins, and you say, thanks for everything, Wildcat fans. It's a great start, and we'll see you next year. And then we find out there is no next year. What is it like receiving this earth-shattering news? And what goes through your mind and what goes through your heart during something like this?
It's been a challenging few weeks. I mean, when we played our last game on March 8th, it was the last XFL game played, Sunday night against the Tampa Bay Vipers. And we had an amazing come-from-behind win that was so exciting and exhilarating. And our team had gotten into a groove where we were going to make a run. To wake up that next Monday morning and to really start to feel the sense that this COVID-19 virus that we've been hearing about so far away was really coming to the United States and was here, it started to dawn on me that this was something serious that we really needed to pay attention to. So a few days later, the season was suspended, but we immediately, you know, we went into planning for 2021 and we didn't even know what was going to happen with the rest of 2020, but there was no sense out of the gates that we wouldn't be back because we had an incredibly successful launch and we were on an amazing trajectory. And a lot of the points that you went through in your question are totally accurate. I mean, we did things differently and we did it the way that we wanted to do it and it was working and our fans showed up. All the benchmarks that we wanted to hit were there. So we all went into strategic planning, but as every week went by, you know, we all started to learn a lot more about COVID-19 and how it was going to impact the sports industry. And it just was evident that there was so much uncertainty. And I think we're still feeling that uncertainty today, unfortunately. From an XFL perspective, we were sitting there at the end of March and we didn't know what was going to happen with the NFL season. We didn't know what was going to happen with college football. We didn't know what was going to happen with the other leagues. And there were all these sort of hypothetical scenarios being thrown around that really could impact our game day schedule come spring 2021. And then there's still a pandemic and a virus that we don't know a lot about. I wasn't in the discussions in Connecticut out of our headquarters where they were running through the scenarios of what to do. I definitely anticipated some sort of furlough of some kind because it's really, really expensive to run a football league. And there's no way that you want to keep pouring money into it when you can't play games and have a business that's generating revenue. So we anticipated something coming, but we didn't know what it was going to be. And then, you know, we were told on a Thursday night to jump on an all hands call on a Friday morning. And we got on the call and there was a 15-minute recording where everybody in the company got laid off, including myself. And 2 days later, the company filed for bankruptcy and it's now going through a Chapter 11 bankruptcy sale process. So it was all very quick. It was all very sudden. As I sort of look back on the whirlwind that was those few weeks, and again, I was not in those discussions, but you know, my takeaway from all of it is that we did not go into bankruptcy because of what was happening with the XFL business. We did everything we set out to do. We were successful. We proved to the world that spring football can work and will work. We had fun doing it. And unfortunately, there were bigger issues at play when it came to the WWE's financial health and what their plans looked like in the time of COVID and how that impacted Vince McMahon and his family's financing of the XFL. You know, it's just unfortunate that there were sort of bigger issues at play that led us to where we are now. But again, an unforgettable journey that I would do all over again. And without great risk doesn't come great reward. So I got a lot out of it.
How did you actually hear the news that the XFL was closing and that bankruptcy was happening? Was it through this call or did you have any sort of note earlier from like maybe media reports or, you know, a notification on your phone? Did it all happen in that meeting or did you have any idea this was coming?
I mean, truthfully, we were all laid off on a phone call where Jeffrey Pollock, the president of the league, laid off everybody on a call and nobody knew that that was the plan. It was an interesting sort of process, to say the least, but you know, I've been in this business for a long time. I've been through a bankruptcy before. I was senior enough to understand the uncertainty of what was happening and what I would do if I was running a league and I was financing the league. I was prepared for some sort of massive furlough or layoff scenario. And it, the bankruptcy piece of it was more shocking, but I can understand it.
What are some of the biggest things that you think we can take away from the XFL as we look back now that will help us move forward with football?
Spring football works. Spring football works. So now that the league is actually in bankruptcy, you know, there are potential buyers out there, and I think somebody will buy it and bring it back. I think we found a really good balance of making sure that this felt like football and not just an entertainment show, while still changing some of the rules to make it more exciting and compelling for spring football. But from a fan engagement standpoint, I think we were super authentic, and we appropriately delivered a great game day experience for folks and families that wouldn't otherwise have them with an NFL team.
If you'd allow us for a little bit here to discuss something, it's personal, it's maybe a little bit uncomfortable, but I think it's important that on the show we talk about something like this and shed light to our listeners. But do you think that you're treated differently because you are a woman in sports?
Definitely not an uncomfortable question, because I get asked it a lot, but it's something, like you said, we have to talk about. We have to talk about it. And it does bring up feelings for a lot that everyone should be confronting and addressing. I think, yes, I get treated differently, but I think in some ways it's in a good way. In some ways it's in a bad way. And I don't think that everybody is treated the same, because I think men and women are different people. And not just because genders are different people, but because every individual is a different person. So there's never like a perfectly exactly similar roadmap for each person. And that is okay. There are definitely points in my career where I stood out more because I was a woman, and that may have led opportunities to come my way. And then there were times where I was overlooked and discounted because I was a woman. And I'm very cognizant of both of those, the good and the bad of it. And I think that is what it is. And you've got to take advantage of the scenarios that work towards your future.
I understand that some of this might be just candidate versus candidate, that you look at candidate A and candidate B, and you don't necessarily look at some of the other things like gender, or are they a minority or are they not? But if you would, what are some of the biggest challenges that you think come with being a woman in a sports world?
I don't really look at it so much from a gender perspective. I really look at it as every candidate is unique because of their own set of experiences, right? And you need to make sure that when you're hiring, that you hire somebody who's the right person for the job, whether they're a man or a woman, or whether they've worked at a sports team before or not, right? You just have to find the right candidate. The same thing goes in, you know, everyday workplace scenarios, is that everyone is going to have their pros and cons based on their own personal set of experiences. And we all need to be cognizant of that.
Is there something we could be doing as a unit and as a better as an industry maybe to get women in higher places of sports? Or is it just as simple as hire the best candidate?
I think it's intention. So I always went out with this intention that I wanted to have the most diverse set of staff for the LA Wildcats that I could. Now, I didn't say I had to interview a woman for every job. I didn't say that I had to interview a Latina or Latino for every department, right? But I knew that it was important that we had a appropriate mix of men and women, of Spanish speakers, etc., go down the list. And I don't think those quotas are important, but I do think that you have to go into a hiring process making sure that you have such a well-rounded group of staff on your team, because all of those experiences are going to contribute to a successful product.
In your role as a president, what skills do you think you need to absolutely excel in to excel in your role?
Super broad question that I think really depends on kind of the role that you're in, but you have to be true to who you are. So I'll just to sort of narrow it down a little bit. When I took the role of president of the LA Wildcats, it was really the first time that I was going to build a team from the ground up, not just a sports team, but build my own staff. So we had to hire a large number of people in a short amount of time, and I had to build the culture for our office and set the tone as a leader. And so I did a lot of reflection to think about what that should be. And the one thing I kept coming back to is be me. And I, for those who know me, I am not a good poker player because I can never, I have no poker face. And I wanted to be the same way as a leader, where I wanted to be honest and authentic. And, you know, I've always tried to share as much as possible with my team so they felt as included and invested into what was going on.
Talking about staying true to yourself in an uncomfortable position, what was it like growing up in Washington, D.C., Redskins country, but being a New York Giants fan?
Well, you did your homework. It was a great life lesson for me because I knew right out of the gates that even as a young girl that I was a bit of a bulldog. And so my dad was a Giants fan. He grew up in Northern Jersey. When I was born, I became a Giants fan as well. So I had a big New York Giants starter jacket in elementary school that I would wear to Redskins games and when the rest of my family who were Redskins fans were watching games. And I just held my own. And I said, I dare you. I dare you to come at me, you know, a young girl Giants fan in the sea of Redskins fans. And I just owned it.
That's so great. I feel like New Jersey has this very interesting sports delicacy where North Jersey is Giants fans, but South Jersey is very popular with the Eagles fans. So like this state divided is going to be such an interesting place to grow up with a football background.
Totally. Well, I'm told that back in the day, the Eagle fans were the worst because they would take rocks and cover them in snow and throw snowballs at Giants fans. So
we're still not great. I got to be honest. I'm an Eagles fan. We're still not exactly the classiest bunch in the group. I don't know. No batteries at Santa Claus anymore.
Right.
So we ask everybody who comes on this show about your why. Like, what is your purpose? And really feeding off of one of the most important themes of the show, that people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. Can you talk about in your life, what is your why? Of all things in the world, why do you work in sports?
You know, I think there are for sure different answers to that question depending on where I was in my life. But the one thing that probably rings true even more today is I want to do something that I love. I really want to do something that I love. And I probably started out this journey saying, I love sports, and so I want to work in sports. I think today I love sports and I appreciate how much sports do, but I really love working in sports because of the sense of togetherness that it brings and the sense of community and how you can bring a smile to somebody's face in the way that we did with the LA Wildcats journey.
Now sitting here at the top of the hierarchy as a president, is there anything that you wish you could go back and tell young Heather, the law clerk for one of the leagues or the intern for the Washington Wizards?
Oh, so much, so much. There were so many years of worrying and stressing out that were probably not needed. But the most important thing that I'm still trying to work on myself is enjoy the moment. Because if you're so worried about the next step or how you're going to get to the next level or the next job or the next landing point, whatever that is for you in your life, either professionally or personally, you're going to miss out on everything great that's happening to you right then.
It's a great answer. And it especially sounds like in your experience with the XFL, it genuinely comes across like you authentically enjoyed every moment that you put into that league. Great answer.
It's very true. Very true. I soaked it all up and memories to last a lifetime. And I'm incredibly grateful to everyone who came out and supported, because even though we are where we are today, our fans showed up.
All right, Heather, this has been extremely informative. And I think your story resonates so deeply on so many different levels. Thanks for really sharing that with us. What we want to do now is we want to get into some quick hitter personal questions, just some goofy things, some of your sports preferences or personal questions, just to get to know Heather Brooks Carrots a little bit. Whenever you're ready, we'll get started here.
Awesome. I told you I'm an open book with no poker face. So
okay,
do it.
Okay. Good thing that you can't see a poker face on audio radio, but let's go. Who is your favorite female athlete of all time?
I mean, I really wish the question was, who is your favorite athlete? Because I don't think we have to separate out female athletes versus male athletes.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because this is where I want to get to. The point of asking the question of who is your favorite female athlete of all time is to kind of bridge the gap. Instead of saying who's your favorite athlete of all time, it's how can we kind of empower women in this role? Let's give them the spotlight and hopefully bring this back into conversation. So we're talking more about Serena Williams than we are ever talking about Mike Trout, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing that there's such a platform right now for female athletes. And I think it's awesome. awesome. And I think that female athletes are really taking advantage of it. And I grew up actually a diehard gymnast. So I look at the gymnasts over the years, and especially over the last couple of years, what the national team and all the high level gymnasts have had to go through, because there's been a lot of challenges on that side. And so, if I have to shout out to anybody, I'm just going to give it up for USA Gymnastics at the moment.
What is your favorite childhood memory of growing up in D.C.?
Growing up in D.C., I think it's what you were talking about earlier. It's just being that young girl in the starter jacket and a sea of Redskins fans and owning it.
What memories do you have about being Heather the intern watching Michael Jordan play in Wizards blue?
It felt a little weird that he wasn't wearing a Chicago Bulls uniform. So I recognize that. But I mean, he is really the greatest athlete ever. And it was amazing to start out my career being close to him and what he was doing. I'm reflecting back on watching The Last Dance recently because it brought back so many great memories. And I think a lot of athletes in this new generation are having the opportunity to relive it, which is great.
Who's your favorite New York Giant of all time?
I'm like a typical New York Giants fan where we're all cynical about our team. But I think I can't go with the Eli Manning era, despite living through the greatest, Super Bowl runs. I do love the Tyree catch on the top of the helmet, but I think LT, Lawrence Taylor, it's got to be.
What are your impressions of Daniel Jones, the new Giants quarterback?
Still too early. We got to see how that one plays out.
That's such a classic Giants fan answer. Such a superficial, like not ready to crown anybody yet, New York answer. I love it.
Yes. Yes.
Yankees or Mets?
Believe it or not, Dodgers, because my family grew up as from Jersey. We were Brooklyn Dodger fans. And then when I came out to LA, I stuck with them.
When your twins grow up, what sports do you hope they play?
I want them to play whatever makes them happy. But I do think that gymnastics gave me this like great foundation of athleticism that let me play all these other sports. So that's a requirement in our household.
Who is your favorite musician of all time?
Another tough one. I can't pick just one, but I will say right now I'm having a big country kick and I'm loving Chris Stapleton, but I love myself some good karaoke and there's no one better than Britney for that.
So being such a proud ambassador of the XFL and the LA Wildcats, think back to your team's roster for a second, because for these next few questions, we're going to give you a scenario and you need to pick one of your former players to help you in this situation. So tell us the player, his position, maybe a little bit about the background and who you would call on these situations. And you can't pick the same player twice. This is the goofy shit we try to get into, Heather. Okay. All right. Scenario number one, you're stranded on a desert island with one player. You have to survive 39 days. Who do you call on?
Boogie. Boogie was just so much fun that I know he would keep me entertained and laughing the whole time.
You're chosen on the Netflix game show, The Floor is Lava. Which of your former LA Wildcats are you bringing with you?
The Floor is Lava? What does that mean?
The Floor is Lava is this new Netflix game show where basically like they make half of the room like lava so you can't step on it. And you have to get through this obstacle course where you're literally like jumping on couches and like the most insecure objects to try and get to the finish line. So it's like this agility game. It's this balance game. So you should probably pick the most athletic person on the team.
Got it. Well, it's got to be Martez Carter. I don't know if you've seen his backflips, but he'd get us through.
That's a great answer. One of the twins needs help with their homework. Which LA Wildcat are you calling on?
Probably Nick Novak. Oldest guy on our team. He's been around the block. He could help the kids.
The oldest guy on the team and the kicker, the guy with the most free time, is basically what you're saying.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
And the last one we have for you, it's fourth and goal. You've got to make a defensive stop to win the game. Who do you trust to make the play?
Defensive stop. Oakman. Got to have the beast, Sean Oakman.
So you graduated magna cum laude from Vanderbilt for your undergrad, but UCLA for your law school. If they were to meet in the national championship game, who do you root for?
Oh, Vandy. Vandy. Go BU. Go Doors.
Heather, what are your fears in life?
You know, as a mom, of course, you want to have like a great long life with your family. But other than that, it's really just not enjoying the present and worrying too much about the future.
And the last one we have for you. Where will we see Heather Brooks Carrots in the next 2 to 3 years?
Wow. Okay. So, well, I'm definitely going to find a new landing spot. So everybody stay tuned. And I'm excited to see where that's going to be. And, I know that it's going to be in something that I love and enjoy and hopefully makes an impact on this world for years to come.
That's so great. Heather, thank you so much for joining us. I think somebody of your title and your prestige in the industry coming to share your story, it's a lot to unpack in a 35 to 45 minute podcast, but we really appreciate you, you know, condensing a million lessons to take out of this and into this format. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story.
Thank you for having me. This has been a lot of fun, and I really enjoy the show.
Today's episode of Hot Coffee Cold Beer is independently produced by Brock L. Hendricks. The content you heard today does not reflect the opinion or views of AEG, Staples Center, the Los Angeles Lakers, Clippers, Kings, or Sparks, or any of its affiliates, subsidiaries, and partners.